No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Thank you so much for being with me today. We're last week's guest was from Tennessee, was from that group in Tennessee where they expelled the two black legislators and they let the... Welcome to Shadow Politics. Today we have a very special guest. We have Representative Zoe Zephyr. She's a Montana state representative, the state's first transgender lawmaker. And unfortunately, she was barred on April 26th by the Republican-controlled House from participating on the House floor for the remainder of 2023. And we're going to talk to her about that. She is a progressive bisexual trans woman who ran for office because she believes the best way to fight for social and economic justice is to get in a room where the laws are being written. And I want to tell you, Representative Zephyr, thanks for being with us. And I train candidates to run for public office. I've done that through a group called Indians List. We train Native American candidates. In fact, we've done some in Montana. But the first thing we tell them is if you don't have a seat at the table, you don't get fed. In fact, you actually might be on the menu if you're not sitting at the table. So I agree with you 100%. It's the best way to fight for social justice. So welcome to the show. And let's first tell everybody who you are. You are the first transgender person elected to the Montana legislature. And you were elected, you won the primary by 61%. And you got almost 80% in the general election. So you're overwhelmingly the representative for the people of Missoula, and the Republicans want to shut you up. Is that right?
Yeah, I was fortunate. You know, my district is a very compact district in Missoula, Montana. And it's a district that I don't have a car. I take public transit through that district every day. I walk through it every weekend. When I knocked the thousands of doors in my district, I was talking to people who I knew, who were my friends and my neighbors. Yeah. And if we hadn't met, we were always one or two people away from knowing someone. So yeah, that is my community. And when they elected me, they elected me to be their voice in the people's house. And that's what I've strived to do every day of the session. And it's what I was able to do up until the Republican speaker refused to recognize me, and the Republican supermajority in the House ultimately censured me and made me leave the House floor.
Well, don't these people understand that this is really not about you, but it's about the people of Missoula who have sent you there? When they censor you, they censor them. When they take away your voice, they take away the voice of your constituents. Why don't they get that? It seems that, from what I've read, it seems like it's a personal attack on you.
What I've said is, you know, that there's nothing more fundamental to our country than the representative democracy, than the idea that people vote to send someone to speak and debate and vote on their behalf. And in my speech during my censure, one of the last things I said was, you know, when he banned me from speaking, he took away the voice of my constituents. And my constituents showed up and stood peacefully in the gallery and said, let her speak, let her speak. And the speaker gaveled them down. And what I said to him in my censure remarks were, when you gaveled down the people in the gallery demanding to let me speak, when you gaveled them down, what you were doing is driving a nail into the coffin of democracy. But democracy will not die that easily.
Well, that's absolutely true. And we should point out that 100 people showed up, 7 of them got arrested. So there is a passionate feeling in Montana that you should be allowed to represent the people that elected you. It's just so crazy to me to see this happen to you. And let me ask you, there's another representative named S.J. Howell who is non-binary, who identifies as non-binary. Do they treat that person the same way?
Representative S.J. Howell, again, first non-binary representative elected to the Montana State Legislature. They're a great friend and phenomenal lawmaker. And they do, you know, yeah, we both have had experiences in the House that what I would say are slightly less than pleasant. But I also think, you know, Howell and I have taken very different approaches for how we discuss these issues, how we talk about them. Howell was making pleas about, you know, we are the Big Sky State. And Howell was making pleas, Representative Howell was making pleas, like, I believe that the sky in Montana is big enough for all families. And then I spoke up and said, yeah, but you're also harming us when you pass this. And so we've both had experiences in the House that have been less than pleasant. But in this particular instance, they singled me out because of remarks I made in particular that they did not like. And so chose to, rather than it be sufficient to pass the legislation, they said, we are going to demand her silence, which I said would be making me complicit in the harm done to my community. And that was not something I could stand for.
Well, and God bless you for your bravery, because that's really what it takes. You know, I've spent the last 17 years fighting with Republicans in Congress to get the people of the District of Columbia a voice. And you really need to be brave to stand up there and say some of the things that you've said. I don't know if people understand this, but in politics, there is a go-along momentum. It's easier to go along with everybody. You'll have a more pleasant experience, but it takes real bravery to stand up there and speak truth to power. And that's really what we're elected to do, is it not?
Yeah, I think there is a tendency in the legislature, because of the wide array of topics covered, because of the speed with which bills get looked at, particularly in a state legislature like Montana that meets for 90 days every 2 years. I've described it often as it feels like it can be all tree, no forest. And because of that speed, and because, you know, people are looking at their bills, there is this tendency to say, well, we need to, you know, I need to be quiet. I need to maybe not say the things that are true or powerful because of all of the other, you know, not to clog the machinery or not to interrupt the machinery of the legislature. But it's important to remember we were elected by our constituents to represent their values, to speak to the real impacts that legislation has on our communities. And while it does, you're always considering the variety of things going on in the legislature. To me, it is integral that we, at the forefront, at the very center, we stand up for what is moral, what is just. We stand up for democracy. And I don't think it should be a hard thing to do that.
It shouldn't be, and unfortunately it is so often, and we see it happening more and more as the country gets divided. You know, like I said, last week we had a representative from Tennessee where they barred two young black elected officials from speaking on the floor. They did the same thing to them, basically, that Montana legislature has done to you. And we see more and more of this, and it's just horrible. And by the way, somebody on my staff just emailed me knowing that you were going to be on the show and said that I should tell you that you have many fans in Washington, D.C., and if you ever want to come here and speak to this issue, that there are people who have volunteered to put you up or find a hotel room for you or whatever you need, because they very much believe in you and what you're doing. You know, we have Burry. I am the father of an openly gay child, and we have very strong laws here in Washington, D.C., and actually in the entire region. As I said before the show, I want to read you something from the Washington Post today, which says that the Trans Health Equity Act has been passed in Maryland. It reduces barriers to gender-affirming care, removing state requirements for those who could receive it. Instead, the new law leaves it up to the patients and their doctors to determine when it is medically necessary. The act also lifts a prohibition on gender-affirming care for Medicaid recipients under the age of 18. And I know this has been an issue for you, has it not? The giving, you know, that they passed, well, explain to us, what is Bill 99, which you don't like?
It's exactly as you talked about. What Maryland is doing is providing protections for people who need gender-affirming care, who need access to this life-saving health care. And in Senate Bill 99 here in Montana, the bill that I rose up in opposition to, that bill seeks to ban gender-affirming care for people under the ages of 18. And it's important to note what gender-affirming care is. And firstly, it is care that is done in conjunction with the patient, their parents, their therapists, their doctors, and done in accordance with every major medical association's guidelines. And at the very beginning, it can be something as simple as social transitioning, which is cutting your hair short, growing it long, wearing different clothes, maybe going by a different name or pronoun. That, something that simple, Senate Bill 99 said, state facilities, that's a no-no. Then you look at things like as a child gets older, maybe at the onset of puberty, if they have been, according to the diagnostic manual, DSM-5, consistent, insistent, and persistent in their gender dysphoria, it would be being on puberty blockers to say, let's put a pause in this for a second, and if you're ready down the road to go transition, we'll do that. And then later, it's hormone replacement therapy, which is the care that I'm on, the medical care that I need to live my life and do the kinds of things that I would not be able to do, have the joy and the purpose and the drive that was not possible prior to my transition. It's that kind of care.
Well, you know, it always amazes me that these guys are willing to fight to the very end to for people to have any damn kind of weapon they want, regardless how dangerous it is. But when it comes, and to have people stay out of your personal lives, but when it comes to, you know, giving a woman the right to choose, or giving you or people like you the right to live your life the way you want to, they want to interfere with it. I really don't get it. But let me ask you, is that what motivated you to get involved? Why did you do this? You were working at the University of Montana. I assume that life was good. Why did you want to be crazy enough to get into this political mess? What was your motivation?
No, I was working at the University of Montana. I was working on a double master's degree while working as staff. And I was also doing community activism, community care, care work, helping people file discrimination claims, helping, you know, build solidarity within the community. And it felt like, you know, that community activism work, that community care is covering up bandaging the wounds left by government. Some wounds intentional, some wounds accidental. Was doing that work, and it felt like the wounds were coming fast, too fast. And I went to testify on bills in the state legislature. Specifically, I was testifying against the anti-trans sports bans, which were the first attacks against the trans community in the most recent wave. And that was never their end game. That was their trying to get in and say, well, if we can, you know, convince somebody to take away trans rights in one aspect, that'll open up the door for, and these are their words, the elimination of trans people from public life entirely. And so I was testifying to a group of people who did not seem to want to hear me. And then I watched bills pass by one vote. Bills targeting my community passed by one vote. And I thought, if we are ever going to move the needle, if we're ever going to truly change hearts and minds, we need representation in those rooms.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, as I said at the beginning of the show, it's the first thing we teach people when we train them to run for public office. The reason to do this is because if your community is not represented, if you're not sitting at the table, you never have the right. You never have your rights protected. You need that representation. You've been in the legislature for a couple of months now, 5 months, right? And so given your experience, would you do this over again? If you could go back to, you know, November 2022, would you run again? Did you make the right choice? Yeah.
Yeah. When you stand up for your community, you're always making the right choice. And I stood up for Missoula, Montana, the place that has cared for me and held me so close throughout the last decade of my life. And it is an honor to get to represent that community in the People's House.
Well, you know what? Thank goodness for people that have that attitude, the kind of attitude that you have, Representative Zephyr, because that's the reason to do it, to realize, and I think a lot of politicians don't get this, that it really is an honor. It really is an honor to have people put that trust in you to represent them. And that's something that must always be at the center of what you do, I think. And I'm not sure why a lot of politicians don't get it. They think it's about them. And, you know, and I'm not going to name anybody in particular, like Donald Trump, but, you know, these guys feel like, you know, often that it's really not about anything but them. Let me read you something else that I read in the paper today, and let me ask you to comment on it. One of the representatives of the LGBTQ community in Washington wrote, "Current political environments across the country are pushing back against the idea that people have the right to identify as transgender. Do you think there's a concerted effort to get against transgenders, or is this just specifically in your case in Montana? Or is this happening all across the country, that there's been a new movement to ban transgenders?"
Well, we have seen over 400 pieces, 450 pieces of anti-trans legislation filed across the country this year. That is more than all other previous years combined. So we are seeing a huge concerted effort to target trans people. And again, as I mentioned just a second ago, this began, they tried with bathroom bans half a decade ago when people went, let people live their lives.
Right.
And then they came back with sports bans. And they tried to make arguments there. And they found that they were able to get some of those passed. And the moment they got those passed, they started pushing more and more extreme bills. And now we're to the point where we're seeing necessary health care taken away from trans people, trans youth, but even in Missouri, trans adults. We're seeing bills like, or we're seeing actions like last year when Governor Greg Abbott sent Child Protective Services to investigate families with trans children. We're seeing laws in Florida, the resurgence of bathrooms bans, one just passed, as well as laws that say you can take a trans child away from their parent, or you can take a child away from a trans parent. And this growing effort is, again, it is one designed to eliminate trans people from public life entirely. And notably, this is an echo of the attacks that were made against the gay community in the 90s. And we know it's an echo because we see the same strategies being played out by the same groups. We see the same, you know, half dozen people who have detransitioned being flown around the country to testify at hearings. We, just like the ex-gays, you know, quote unquote, in the 90s, we see language in the 90s that was used, you know, harmful language saying that gay people were, quote, recruiting children. And now in this stage of what the attacks against trans people, we're seeing harmful language where they're saying trans people are, quote, grooming children, end quote. That is harmful, false language, and it's attacking in the same way that the 90s attacks against the gay community were. And it will fail for the same reason those attacks failed, because trans people are part of your communities. We are in every community. And by and large, our communities know us, care for us, and support us.
Well, one of the problems that we've had in the District of Columbia is attacks on trans people, physical attacks. It's been, other than that, legally, I think trans people have basically the same rights that anybody else has in the District of Columbia. But we have seen over the last couple of years, and it's disturbing, an increase in physical attacks against trans people. Is that what you're seeing across the country as well?
Yes, and it's important. So there's two impacts from the legislation. There's the harm that it brings when you take away health care from someone who needs that health care to have the pursuit of happiness that our country was built upon. And then also, when you use rhetoric like groomer and pedophile to describe people just living their lives, when you drum up fear and try to create a boogeyman, there will be people who will take that rhetoric seriously and seek to do harm. And we've seen that in Montana. I know of people who were attacked on the side of the road. There was someone who was run over by a truck. And notably, as you mentioned, in D.C., we also see the way in which these attacks on trans people, like all things, need to be considered intersectionally. It's important to note that the epidemic of violence against trans people involves a lot of Black trans women, that they are getting impacted at even a further rate of harm. And we're looking at the ways in which marginalized communities are starting to rise back up against this and hold the powerful accountable. They look what these bills are doing. Look what they are, who they are hurting. They are hurting a community that needs care, and they're hurting a community that are your friends and neighbors.
Do we need to re-educate people? In the District of Columbia, we have a gay lesbian task force, and we have a unit in the police department that's specially trained to deal with gay, lesbian, transgender people. The police are given special training on some of the issues that community, that your community faces. Do we need to do more of that? Do we need police departments like that in every state? And do we need to do a re-education program? Because I think a lot of this comes out of fear. I mean, I don't know why people would be afraid, but I think a lot of it is generated by fear. So do we need to re-educate America?
I think what we need is people in our communities to stand up. As I said, you are never far from a trans person or someone who loves us dearly. And so if there's a trans person in your life, listen. Listen with an open heart and an open mind, because if it feels like a light switch moment to you that someone was going by one name and whatnot, and then suddenly it's different, know that for the trans person, those are slow decisions, but there's a lot of careful consideration, and quite frankly, given what we've talked about, fear as well. And if there are allies and friends of the LGBTQ community, talk to them, stand up in defense of our community. And again, that you use the word re-education, but what it really is empathy. It is knowing that we're a part of your community, knowing that you can come talk to us and we are not boogeymen. And we are seeing, as more people begin to have trans people in their lives, the appetite for legislation targeting us is dwindling. And we will see, we are already seeing that shift in our communities. And as legislation often does, we will see that follow suit in our legislatures down the road.
Well, you know, again, I couldn't agree with you more. I use this method that you just talked about to keep, you know, I live in a very, very liberal, almost isolated community from Republicans. I think we have 10 Republicans in D.C. Almost everybody's a Democrat. But I remember that there are Republicans that I know that I love. There are friends I have that I love and respect that are Republicans. And there are, you know, people in my family that are Republicans. So that when I think about Republicans, I try to think about that. I hate a lot of the policies that they put forth, especially recently. But I say to myself, you know, I don't want to sound like the former president, but there really are good people out there on both sides. So I think what you say is really important here, that we all have to understand that we're part of the same community, and that, you know, and that would move us forward. I think that's absolutely brilliant. Let me ask you, the bathroom thing, that really gets me, because I've been in plenty of ladies' rooms as a confirmed heterosexual. When I was a kid, I was raised by a single mom, and if we were out somewhere and she needed to use the restroom, I came with her. Maybe a little uncomfortable, but I remember it, you know, and I don't know. And I think that was when I'm considerably older than you are, but in my day, that was a regular practice. Nobody thought anything of taking little boys into the ladies' room. So I don't know why it became an issue. But the sports thing is more complicated. Can we talk about that for a minute? I think that there are a lot of people that feel like, you know, there's this swimmer. I can't remember her name. But
Leah Thomas?
Yeah, Leah Thomas, right, exactly. And there are people that feel that she has an unfair competitive advantage by, you know, that, and if women who are biologically, who are born or identified as women at birth, if they want to compete with somebody like this, they have to take steroids in order to build up the muscle that a transgender can have. So what do we say about that?
So, and I'll, as background for this, I'll let folks know that I was a high level athlete prior to my transition, multiple state championship wrestler, recruited for colleges across the country. I know the impact that transition has had on my athletics. I know the way in which my mile time has shifted, my weightlifting has shifted. I see that. And it's important to note that prior to her transition, I believe Leah Thomas was about 10 seconds behind the world record in the men's division prior to her transition. Post her transition, she is the same distance behind the women's world record. This is an NCAA athlete, a high-level athlete. And so we're talking about the cream of the crop of athletics here, and she was good, and she is good, and that's okay to be good. But what we're seeing is when people are trying to drum up fear around trans athletes and say, oh, look, they have this huge advantage, they will take the successes of a trans athlete, hard-earned successes. Leah Thomas broke record and won. And then what is missing from the conversation is the very next year, Leah Thomas's teammate, a cisgender woman, broke that record, competed in the category and broke the record that Leah Thomas had set the previous year. But the people who want to exclude trans people from sports will only hear that first side, that Leah Thomas, a hardworking, high-level athlete, worked her butt off and won an award. And then they won't hear that another athlete, a cisgender athlete, broke that record again the next year. And so it's always important to note that the people who are making these arguments about sports are looking to put an asterisk on trans women and their womanhood. And trans women, our womanhood doesn't come with an asterisk. We are women. And I think the sports conversation also, you know, in Biden's proposed Title IX policy, there were questions about how this would impact high school sports and whether or not, you know, there shouldn't be any exclusion at low sports, but there was an opening potentially made for the argument that if, you know, a college scholarship were on the line in high school sports. And I want you to think, I talked about the way trans healthcare works. Imagine a young trans woman, 9 years old, playing basketball. She's on the girls' team. She's playing basketball with her girl teammates, having a great time. She plays with them up through high school. She is on puberty blockers and then goes on to hormone replacement therapy and is going through puberty as a trans woman, as a woman. And then the administration comes in and says, hey, we know you've been playing basketball with your teammates here on the girls' team for the last 7 years. But these girls have a chance at a scholarship now. And so that varsity slot that you were playing for, you don't get to have that anymore. That itself, like, that is discrimination. That is at its core unfair to a trans athlete. And my desire is that trans athletes get to participate in sports, because I know what the kinds of lessons sports taught me growing up. I know that I would not be able to be the woman I am today without those lessons. And for those who want to have sports as part of their life, they deserve the ability to participate, to compete. And if they work hard and win, those victories should be celebrated just like we would do for any other athlete.
Well, I can tell you, I agree that sports teaches you many lessons. I was the worst kid on my Little League team. The worst. I was a perpetual bench warmer as I was growing up, because I just wasn't very good at sports. But I got a lot out of sports. I got a lot out of being on the team, even though I wasn't a very good athlete. You know, my older brother, who was a good athlete, suggested that I change my name at one point because I was interfering with his reputation as a great baseball player. I didn't do that, you know, but even though he said to me, we had a big station wagon, and he said, if mom ever sells the station wagon, it'll cut you from the team. The only reason you're there is because you can take 9 kids to the game. But I learned a lot of lessons as well, and I agree. But let me ask you, since you brought up basketball, if you look at Brittany Griner, for example, she's 6'9", but that's very, very unusual for a woman. Okay, she's not transgender, but that's very unusual. But it's not so unusual for men. There are very few college basketball teams anymore that don't have at least 2 or 3 guys on the team that are 6'9" or taller. Isn't that an unfair advantage if you're a trans woman and you're 6'10" and you're playing women's basketball? Isn't that?
I'm just playing
devil's advocate here. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I know that's the argument.
I'll bring up two points, and the first of which is, you bring up Brittany Griner. We do not take someone's, you know, size, height, weight in basketball in consideration. We don't say, yeah, but you fall outside of the average height for a woman, and therefore we're not going to allow you. We don't have those kinds of, you know, Michael Phelps wingspan isn't brought up and saying, hey, listen, we know that's who you are and how you're made, but that's not fair. We let people be themselves and compete and partake in sports as they see fit. And the other thing is, it's important to note, we are not seeing a huge amount of trans athletes, you know, as the folks on the right would make you believe, you know, taking over sports. Trans women, trans people as a whole are underrepresented in athletics. We are a much smaller percentage of the athletic community than we are of the general population. And I think that when people try to create fear-mongering around, well, what if someone went through biology and was tall? They are missing the point that those people don't aren't really existing there. They are underrepresented in athletics as a whole. And if that was really something to be concerned about, we'd see trans people at a much higher proportional representation in sports. And lastly, I want to say that people who are bringing this up and saying, well, what if a trans person, you know, what if a trans woman went through a male puberty and is now taller and, you know, is 6'4". These are the same folks that are seeking to ban healthcare for trans youth, who are coming out and saying, you do not get to access that life-saving care that you need. We are going to force you through a puberty. And then when you've gone through that puberty, we're going to tell you, because of that, you are disallowed from partaking in athletics. And to me, that is discrimination and wrong, morally wrong, on every step of the way.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. I think that, you know, I read an article one time that Michael Jordan, who had phenomenal skills at every level, also had, they tested him, and he had peripheral vision that goes beyond average peripheral vision. One of the things that made him such a good team player. And I think you find that in sports in general, that at an elite level, and you know this better than I do, they're very often people have special talents or special gifts, physically and otherwise, and they're not disqualified.
And we also, it's a good reminder to, you know, when we talk about the impact of, you know, violence against Black trans women, and we think about the intersectionality of these issues, it's important to remember that, you know, this kind of investigation into women's athletics in the Olympics particularly began with this very racist roots of targeting, saying, okay, well, what is woman enough? What is an appropriate build? What is acceptable in women's athletics? And I think it's important to keep in mind how all of these attacks are connected.
Let me ask you, let's switch gears a little bit here. You have been, they've canceled hearings on issues in committee, on the committees in which you serve. I mean, it seems like these guys, these people, I shouldn't say guys, but these people, you were seated in the hall at one point, and the next day people came and sat where you were sitting so you couldn't sit. They've canceled these hearings. You brought a lawsuit. And it seems to me that the people that have joined your lawsuit, or the people willing to represent you, there's a lot of support there. So tell me about the lawsuit. What do you hope to gain with that?
Well, as you say, it's important to note that every step of the way, the Republican supermajority, the Speaker, and his supporters have looked to take the most undemocratic action they could take. It wasn't enough just to say, hey, we object to that. They wanted to not recognize me. They shooed the protesters out via police. They wound up closing the gallery to the public for the rest of the session. When I sat in a public area, the speaker came out to deny me the ability to sit in a public area and said, you need to be out of sight, often one of the minority leaders' sections. And so there's been an undemocratic action taken along the entire way. And I think when I brought forward a suit, and when there was a suit from my constituents as well, the understanding is essentially twofold. One, we have a right to free speech in this country, and that right does not go away when you are elected. Duly elected officials do not have fewer constitutional protections than the citizens they represent. And two, our country has built on that representation, something I'm sure rings incredibly true in D.C. And our communities deserve a right to that representation. And to say that a legislature can deny a member that representation, that ability to speak on the floor by a two-thirds vote, is to say that any supermajority in this country could silence any member of the superminority for any reason. And that should be a very harrowing thought to anyone who cares about democracy in this country, and it's why it is so important that we stand up.
Again, I agree with you. The District of Columbia is currently under attack. We just had Congress overturn a bill. This just blows me away. We had Congress overturn a bill that I didn't agree with, by the way, but they overturned a bill that was legally passed by our legislature with 12 out of 13 councilmen pass legislation. But every piece of legislation that's passed in the District of Columbia has to go sit on Capitol Hill for 30 days for their tacit approval. They haven't overturned a bill in more than 30 years, but they overturned this bill because they can, and now they've moved on to another bill that's actually a law that's been enacted. They're going to try to overturn that bill and they just voted again a couple of weeks ago to overturn that. And it's been passed on now to the Senate, I believe. But yeah, it's really, really important that you at least get to speak, that you at least, get to represent the people that elected you and have their voice heard. So what is a lawsuit attempt to do? Are you suing for the right to be heard? Are you suing? I'm sorry, I don't know anything about the lawsuit. Are you suing the speaker and the other people that are you suing them as individuals, or how does that work?
It was a suit against the Speaker of the House in his official capacity as Speaker, the Sergeant at Arms in his official capacity, and the state of Montana. And the suit was initially brought and was seeking a temporary restraining order because in the last week of the session, we were hearing over 100 bills that impacted my community, and not just the LGBTQ community, but important bills around housing, some good ones and some bad ones. We were also hearing the state's budget bill coming forward for final approval in the House. And there were 11,000 Montanans, my constituents, whose voices weren't being heard on those bills. And so the suit sought a temporary restraining order to get me back in. Unfortunately, that was not granted. And we in the legislature wrapped up their business and adjourned yesterday.
So it's moot at this point, I guess. But let me ask you.
But the harm has been done at this point.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And let me ask you, if you meet, you only meet every 2 years?
Yeah, Montana is one of the few legislatures in the country that is a every other year legislature. We meet for 90 days every 2 years.
So how often are you elected?
Every 2 years.
Every 2 years. And what do you do when you're not in session?
So when we are not in session, I partake in interim committees. And that means that I will meet with other members of the legislature to go over policy, more of a deep dive into policy, so that when we start the next session, we have a handful of well-studied bills that we can work on together. And then also, I will be traveling around my community and talking to, a newly formed tenants union in Missoula, Montana, and saying, what do we want to see to protect renters in our state? What is on your priority list for policy going forward? and doing work like that. And then also, given the attention of the undemocratic actions taken here in Montana and across the country, you know, I think of Senators Megan Hunt and Michaela Kavanaugh in Nebraska. Think of Senator Maury Turner, or Representative Maury Turner in Oklahoma, and then the Tennessee Three. You know, it is part of the work is connecting with them and seeing how do we make sure that these attacks on our democracy, that folks who saw us as legislators rise up and stand in defense of democracy, how do we make sure that our communities in our states and across the country also understand that courage can be contagious, and it's in your communities it is noble and worthy to stand as well. How do we take that moment and help it become a movement?
Do you aspire to higher office to get that message, make that message more prolific? Do you think about running for Congress or running for running for governor, running for some other office that's higher up the ladder that would give you more of an ability, more, a bigger platform, a bigger venue? Is that entered into your thinking, or after 5 months in the legislature, it's too early to talk about stuff like that?
You know, when I initially sat down, again, I think we talked about this earlier, but I sat down with Senator Bryce Bennett, the first openly gay man elected to the Montana State Legislature. And what I told him was that my hope, my drive, was to get in the room where my voice could do the most good. And I feel like I have been in that room. I am fighting in the legislature to do the most good that I can. And given that the world turned and looked at Montana, and saw how undemocratic the actions were, and saw that there was a glimpse of what our state could be if we stand up and defend democracy, I've had the blessing of being invited into other rooms, rooms like this conversation. And so where my focus is right now is saying, here are the rooms that I'm being invited into. Here are the rooms where my voice can do the most good. And I'm trying to stay in that moment and do the most good. And I will always look for that room, wherever it is, to find where I can do the most good for my people, my constituents, and the state I love.
Well, again, I think your motivation is exactly what the motivation of every politician should be, you know, and so I commend you for that. But I know you have to go, Representative, that you have other stuff that needs to be done. So let me ask you before we close on this conversation, is there something you want to say? Is there some question I didn't ask you? Is there anything that you want to add? Is there a website that you have where people can learn more about this? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so my website is zoezephyr.com, Z-O-O-E-Y-Z-E-P-H-Y-R. It's in the process of being updated because, as we mentioned earlier, we're a little state of Montana out here. And then also you can find me at Zoan to Behold on any social media platform. That is Z-O-A-N-D-B-E-H-O-L-D. And my sort of closing remarks would be an echo of what I just said. Courage can be contagious, and I hope people across this country, when they see their elected representatives standing up, when they see leaders and organizers in their communities standing up for democracy, standing up for the just and moral thing, I hope people know that whatever room they are in is no more or less important than the rooms their electeds are in. And if you stand up for what is just and right, we will move the needle on all the issues that matter. Trans rights, the fight for democracy, disability rights, abortion rights, health care, housing. Every time we stand up for what is just and right, we make this our state, my state, and this country a better place, and a place we can be proud to call home and proud to put our roots in.
Well, that's an amazing place to stop. I commend you for your courage, Representative Zephyr. Thanks so much for coming on our show. At the end of every show, we do a song to play us out, and we dedicate that to our guest. And so today, it seemed like there was no more appropriate song than the one we're going to play from Benny King, Stand By Me. So please know, Representative Zoe Sefer, that there are plenty of people in Washington, D.C., that are, and I'm certainly one of them, that are willing to stand with you in this cause. And thank you so much, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to stand with all of you.
Thanks. We'll see y'all next week, folks, and think long and hard about what Representative Zephyr has said today, because it's not only an issue that's important to our democracy, but it's one that doesn't get as much exposure as it should. And the law that was passed in Maryland recently, I commend the governor, a Democrat, who stood up and helped shepherd this through the legislature and is proud, makes a statement in the Washington Post today that he's proud that the state has passed this law, even though they said that they expect the juvenile provision in this law would only affect a handful of people. The governor rightfully said that it shows that the state supports the trans community, and we all must do that. So we'll see you next week. Here's a song from Benny King. Thanks so much, Representative Zephyr.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only
representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.